Welcome to the show, amigos. We have Yoan Grillo joining us. He is a journalist, a writer, and a TV producer based in Mexico City. He's also the author of the critically acclaimed book, El Narco. He's going to be in New York on January 20th at the Mid-Manhattan Library at 455 Fifth Avenue. He's going to be presenting his latest book called Gangsta Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. The event is going to start at 6:30. I'm going to be there, and I'm inviting you to come along and check out this great book and say hello. I also want to tell you that the new website is finally up, and you can find that over at robaguilarshow.com. At the website, you'll find the archives of all previous episodes, so you can download them and take them with you, or subscribe via iTunes or Stitcher Radio. I also want to send a shout out to our Radio Free Brooklyn listeners. So make sure you check out the new website. Make sure you come out to this event on the 20th at the Mid-Manhattan Library starting at 6:30 p.m. If you want to get in touch with me, or if you have any questions regarding this event, shoot me an email, robaguilarshow@gmail.com. You can also send me your suggestions, your comments, if you have a topic that you'd like for us to cover. So we've got a great show lined up. Stick around. You do not want to be left out.
From A1 Studios in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, New York, this is the Rob Aguilar Show.
Yoan, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here.
So Yoan, you are living this fascinating, exciting life in Mexico, covering crime and the drug cartels. You originally are from England.
That's right, yeah. I grew up in near a city called Brighton on the southeast coast of England. It's a beach town with a stony beach, a lot of nightclubs, quite a cool place.
When did you decide you wanted to be a journalist?
So I messed around a bit with my life in my late teens and my early 20s. And did quite a lot of traveling and living different things. And I spent about a year in the Middle East altogether, but working, you know, different jobs, even on construction sites and that kind of thing. Did my university a bit later when I was 23 to when I was 27. And during that, I spent a year living in Spain where I taught English and did some studying and learned Spanish. And for a long time, I'd been attracted to the idea of journalism and finally wanted to really, you know, get moving with it. And I'd met various Latin American people, both in Spain and in other places, and was very attracted to that culture, found that, you know, Latin America, a very fascinating part of the world. So when I looked at how I would really get into doing journalism, you know, I could start at a local newspaper in Brighton, or I could, you know, go off to Latin America and just get in there and do it. You know, one way in was to start an English language paper in Latin America. And so I found out I could do that. I could fly to Mexico City and start a newspaper called The News in Mexico City, which paid about $600 a month for a job. And I could start there and just dive straight in and start kind of living the dream, covering stuff here.
Had you ever been to Mexico before that?
I hadn't. I'd never been to Mexico or to Latin America before I came here to start doing journalism. Like I said, I'd spent a year in Spain. I'd been around the Middle East, in Syria, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Turkey. I'm around a lot of European countries. But my first time in Mexico.
So were you always attracted to excitement? You said you were in the Middle East. Was it during dangerous things going on in the Middle East that you were there?
I was in the Middle East. The Middle East has been a tense region for some time. But the time I was there was not as crazy as it is now. I was in the Middle East in 91 and 94, a year altogether. But it was 4 months and then 8 months. And when I was there, I was there just after the first Gulf War. So when George Bush Sr. Led the invasion of Kuwait back in 1991. And then I was there in 1994. And there was things happening then. There was various massacres and things happening. But, it was not a a crazy time of conflict as much as it is now.
So when you decided to go to Mexico, what drew you there? Part of like the organized crime? Was it like, you know what, I want to go down to Mexico and cover organized crime and the drug cartels? Was that part of the attractiveness of Mexico?
It wasn't actually. When I was attracted to Latin America more because of the culture, because of people I'd met from Latin America. Mexicans, Brazilians, Colombians who I'd met in Europe. And I just really liked the people I met and really liked the kind of attitude of being kind of sociable and laid back, which I found with a lot of these people. So it wasn't really anything to do with the crime. I actually had a bit of a vision or a bit of a perception of covering Latin America from the old stories of the 1980s, so back in the Cold War. And I saw this movie, Salvador, by Oliver Stone, mm-hmm. back in the 1980s, and this kind of idea of a journalist running around covering this civil war, which seemed very romantic and exciting. So I kind of had a perception of that. I didn't really know much or have much idea about the issues of Mexico and the issues of Latin America in the 21st century. You know, I arrived in the year 2000. So, and I arrived when that Cold War was all finished. This idea of kind of guerrilla groups fighting governments had basically kind of ground to a halt. We're kind of an era of free market capitalism was kind of much stronger. So that's the time I arrived in and didn't really know much or think much about organized crime.
What was your first impression? Let's say you're planning this trip and finally the day comes that you're leaving for Mexico. You obviously had some ideas of what it was like or what it was going to be like. How was that different from what you actually saw when you got off that plane into the street? Was it different than what you imagined? What were your first impressions?
Sure. So I was 27 years old when I made this trip to Mexico. Had a one-way ticket and the idea of you know, I'm going to go there and be a journalist. And some people, you know, my parents thought it was just some kind of fantasy. I'd come back in a month's time or whatever. And a lot of friends of mine were not that encouraging. Were like, kind of, yeah, whatever, you know, kind of some kind of fantasy kind of trip you do. So I had a big going away party. I'd spent a few months before I left working at a call center and credit control, to pay off some of my debts and get enough money to get started. But I arrived at a one-way ticket and got off the plane, and I had a kind of going away party. So I was up all night before I left and arrived quite hungover and got off the plane in the evening. And one of the first things, kind of sad to say, one of the first things that hit me was the smell. Mexico City's got quite a distinct smell. If you know, now I've been here 50 yeah. years, I don't notice it. But it's a smell, it's a combination, I think, of cooking, the grease and the corn on the street, the pollution, you know, a whole bunch of things. It's a very, very distinct. I was like blasted by this kind of smell. And I remember looking for something to eat and seeing the prices and the symbol for the Mexican peso. To me, it looked like a dollar sign. You know, it's this S with a line through it. So I was looking around for something to eat and saw the price of tacos and thought they were priced in dollars. Thought, oh my God, this is crazy expensive. I'm not going to be able to eat anything here. And eventually walked around and found a place selling tortas you know, these big kind of sandwiches, these tortas, and they just had it was 20 pesos, I remember, which was a big 20, with, you know, when I was just sitting, and got a torta, you know, this huge sandwich, the first thing I ate in Mexico, which was a great treat.
So you've never had Mexican food in England before that either, huh?
I had Mexican food in England, but really, I mean, Mexican food in England is very far away from Mexican food. You know, I go back to England now and go to the Mexican restaurants, which are very popular, but they really are not very Mexican at all.
So this first sandwich that you had, was it from like a street cart or was it like an actual restaurant?
Yeah, from a street cart was the first street stall.
You're definitely quite the risk taker.
Yeah. I mean,
did it make you sick?
No, that first sandwich. I mean, I did get sick in some of my early times in Mexico, but not from that sandwich. I got sick a couple of times from eating some. When I first got to Mexico, I spent about 5 or 6 weeks just trekking around the country before I started actually getting work in a newspaper. So I went down to the beach in Oaxaca and I remember I had some oysters on the beach there in Oaxaca, and I got sick from those. That's the first time I got really sick. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think the food issue in Mexico is not such a big deal. I mean, there are some things, you know, that, you know, if you're not used to the food, you're going to get sick, you know, one or two times, but it's not a huge deal, I don't think.
I think your body eventually over time adjusts to it. We always joke, once you get the bug in you, you're fine and you can survive without nothing major happening. So did you have a place already set up for you to stay, or are you just wandering Mexico? Was there a plan behind that, or are you just going to live an adventurous situation? I'm just going to head down there and I'm going to find shelter where I find it, and I'm going to just live this adventure.
So back then, I remember I found a place, a cheap hotel in the historic center of Mexico City, which was, I remember back then, was about 80 pesos a night, which is about that back then $8 a night for a place to stay. And then, you know, went off backpacking around Mexico and eventually found an American guy who let me stay at his house for a little while, and then found a place where I could rent a room with a woman, a señora, who rented out rooms. And that's when I found it. And then, eventually, when I actually started teaching English in Mexico, I'd done that in Spain, so I had practice teaching English. So I taught some English to get some more money, although I had money saved up to come out. You know, your money quickly starts running out, so I just wanted to keep afloat. So I was teaching English to business executives, and then I started applying for the job at the newspaper, and once I started applying, it took me about 2 months still to actually get my job. You know, for a job, the first job came up, a couple of people applied, I didn't get it, the second job came up in the newspaper and I got it. And that first job at the newspaper, like I said, paying $600 a month, but that was great. That's opening a door. That first door in journalism that opens is in many ways the most important door. You know, once you go through that first door, you go into that world of being a journalist. And that's a very kind of life-changing moment for me in many ways.
What kind of stories were you covering at that first job?
So, I mean, when I first got in the newspaper, actually, even the job had come up at the culture section of the newspaper. So I was straight, you know, just in there, and, you know, some of the first things I was covering were things like an opera coming to Mexico City, a ballet dance, and these kind of things I knew nothing about. But I was already, started keen on this, started building up the more kind of crime, kind of street thing very early on. And, you know, one of the things I went to a place in Mexico City where they had a center for kind of gang rehabilitation, and they had these big graffiti writing shows. So I went down there. So it was cultural elements, but I started finding different cultural elements of graffiti writers, you know, hip hop MCs, you know, different stuff, which kind of started bringing me more into the kind of street level, kind of underground stuff, which I found very interesting. And then from there, I kind of fought my way into covering general news for the newspaper and started covering more the crime beat. So I started covering fascinating stories back then, like I covered the court martial of these two generals on trial for drug trafficking, and started covering these issues of the drug traffickers back then in 2002, around this time, and started to meet some of Mexico's, or communicate with some of Mexico's great journalists who cover this, like this guy, Jesus Blanconelas from Tijuana. You know, one of the, you know, real legend in covering this. You know, a guy was shot four times by a gangbanger from San Diego, actually, who went into Mexico and shot him. And he started telling me a lot of, you know, great things, great anecdotes, giving me great advice and guidance about covering this issue.
I guess he was going over details of how dangerous the job could be. Did you ever touch on that?
With him, it wasn't so much that. He'd often just, you know, he'd educate me about what was happening in the world of drug trafficking. He used to write sports, so he'd make a lot of sports metaphors. So he'd talk about some drug trafficker. I said, you know, what about this guy? And he'd say, oh, that guy was, you know, he's more like in baseball, he'd be in the minor leagues. Mm. That guy's not really a big player. And I'd say, he'd talk about, you know, this guy, El Mayo Zambada, that guy, he'd be playing for the New York Yankees. so that's kind of metaphors he'd make. So I don't know much about baseball. You know, I grew up in a place where it's mainly soccer, or we call football.
Exactly.
But I managed to grasp these metaphors. Okay.
So when was your first, like, real introduction to, like, wow, the seriousness of the crime and the drug cartels with all their power? Like, when did you see, like, this is a real, real issue that is not only dangerous, but affects communities, affects an entire country and everyone else around it? Like, when did you think that, when were you submerged into that? When was that first experience with this hardcore, gritty crime?
So it's a couple of years later. So I worked at the news until the end of 2002. I was actually laid off from the news because the newspaper shut down that particular version. And I went into becoming a freelancer. And then I found a job writing from Mexico for the Houston Chronicle in Houston, Texas. So I was working alongside a legendary journalist called Dudley Outhouse, you know, a guy who's now turned about 60, who's, you know, one of the real legends of American journalists covering Mexico, been here for decades. I worked with him. He was my mentor, and he really taught me so many things and really got me to being a decent journalist. And while I was working there for the Houston Chronicle, in 2004, this violence began on the Mexican border with Texas in the city of Nuevo Laredo. And the Houston Chronicle sent me up to cover this. Now, Dudley at that time was going around the world a lot. He was based in Mexico, but he was going off to Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, all these crazy countries. And this was kind of a local story on the Texas border. He said, no, you go and cover that. So I went up to cover that. And I didn't realize this. None of us realized this at the time, but it was actually a very historic thing happening there. A new type of violence was emerging. It was no longer these gangbangers, these guys with shaved heads and tattoos, shooting people with pistols or cutting them up with knives. It was these drug traffickers using paramilitary units, bunch of guys with AK-47s, RPG-7 grenade launchers, organized like guerrilla forces, like military units. And this because this group, the Zetas, was there fighting, who were former soldiers themselves who defected to fight with drug traffickers. So I went up covering this story from 2004 to 2005. And this was really a very crucial turning point. From there, this violence would spread across Mexico. But at that moment, it was kind of a local story. And I saw starting some crazy things. I interviewed one guy there who became then the police chief. I interviewed him a couple of weeks later. He became the police chief. When he became the police chief, he swore in, and a journalist asked him, are you scared? He said, no, I'm not scared. The people who are scared are the corrupt people. You know, I'm honest, so I'm not scared they're going to kill me. And about 6 hours after he made that statement, he was shot dead.
Wow.
And I'd just been talking to this guy a couple of weeks before, and I was like, oh, wow, this is a bit more scary. It's a bit more hardcore, this stuff. And started covering this conflict and driving around with other Mexican journalists who would drive around in cars and shoot really fast in these crime scenes. We'd run up and turn up, and there'd be a dead body on the street, all the bullets there, all this chaos. And start getting that adrenaline of covering that issue and start realizing, yeah, this is something quite crazy. I still at that time did not realize, of course, I did not realize at that time where this would go. I had no idea that this would lead to a situation where in 7 years you'd see 83,000 people being killed. I could imagine that would lead to a situation where you'd have mass graves with 193 bodies or massacres of 72 people. I didn't believe that. But I saw this is kind of a crazy story. And that was kind of the moment there when I started getting a bit more hardcore into covering and understanding this issue.
I'm assuming the first time that you saw or heard or witnessed firsthand something like this, or covering a story with that much violence and people getting shot and decapitated and all that crazy stuff, does it ever become normal where it's like, ah, just another body, just another dead person? Or does something more human happen inside us where you never get used to it?
It does tragically become normal in a way. I mean, I'd never seen a dead body in England. The closest I came to a dead body one time, I worked in a hospital, and we carried some guy who died down to the freezer. I mean, okay, I handled a dead body. I'd never seen a gunshot victim in this sense. So when I first started seeing dead bodies on the concrete arriving at a place, you've got, you know, guys whose brains have been blown out with AK-47 bullets. It's quite shocking. Now, It's funny when you watch movies and people see their bodies and they throw up, because that never happens. I've never seen anyone do that. I've never felt physically sick seeing their bodies. You just see them. It's more of a kind of emotional impact. But when I first, you know, start covering this, and then over the years, I mean, this was an escalation. So I got to 2008, and in that year, where you started getting a real escalation of violence, because this began gradually. You had it 2004, 2005, during, you know, during a year, 1,500 people being killed, and by 2008, they shot to 6,000-7,000. By 2011, it shot to almost 17,000. So it's a kind of gradual escalation. But when I got to this stage where you started seeing, you know, dozens, hundreds of people being killed, and I go to these places like Sinaloa, see that come back, and sometimes it'd be, you know, you'd have this in your dreams, you'd still be kind of lying awake, you see these kind of bodies in your dreams. But it does tragically become normal. You know, you're used to seeing it. I mean, you arrive with the local Mexican journalists who cover this, and it's like, you know, you've seen so many of these things that, you know, it's nothing new. However, I find what really brings it home, more than seeing the flesh on the concrete, is seeing the families. When you see the faces of families, when people arrive and it's their son or their husband or their father, and the pain they have, you know, I never get used to that. And still sometimes, you know, more recently, there was a case where an American, Harry Devant, was killed in Mexico. And I was in contact with his mother, based in the New York area. And I talked to her, and just hearing the pain in her voice was, you know, still really brings it home. And that's something I think you can never get used to. You know, you still need to reserve your humanity of that loss. Immense loss of people, which really is the real big thing here.
Sounds very tense and very deep. Now, how dangerous is what you do?
There are many dangerous jobs that people do around the world. Firefighters do dangerous jobs. Coal miners do dangerous jobs. So being a journalist covering a violent situation is one more of those. It has a lot of glamour attached to it as well. I mean, people make movies about journalists and war correspondents. They don't make as many movies about, you know, just about firefighters or about coal miners. So there's certain glamour attached. The danger's there, and it's present, and it's real, and you have to be aware of that. You know, you have to be aware if you're going to be in a situation where there's a shootout. You have to be aware those bullets can hit you. You have to be aware if you're around people with guns, that those guns can fire, that those people are not, you know, these people are murderers. And you have to be aware, you know, all the time just of being in very, very dangerous places of what those risks are. However, Mexico as a place to work, or Latin America as a place to work, is not as dangerous for foreign journalists arriving here at some other parts of the world right now, like Syria. I mean, Syria, I think, is a place that has become so dangerous that it's almost impossible for journalists to do their job there, for foreign journalists to go into Syria and to really report on that situation. I don't think they can do it adequately. Whereas Mexico, Latin America, journalists, we can still work here. We can still report on this. We can still do our job in this situation.
You've been in Mexico now 13, 14 years?
Yeah, it'd be 15 years.
If you could go back in time, let's say, to 15 years ago and talk to Johan the minute he gets off that plane, and you could offer Johan advice about what he's going to get into, what would you tell him?
I'd probably find myself... you know, being young and dumb, like nowadays, sometimes, you know what it's like, as you get older, you start seeing sometimes younger people, you know, I still see now younger journalists in their 20s wanting to start. And you know, you sometimes find them a little bit, you know, innocent, naive. You can become more jaded as you get older. But that, you know, that young optimism and that young naivety is a great thing, really. The advice I give younger journalists now, in a way, the easy way to answer is how I give advice to young journalists now who come and say, you know, how do I get into this? What do I do? And I would say to younger journalists now, it's a good thing to find a story which you can cover, which you can specialize in, and which you can stand out covering. And that's one way to make your mark, to get out there and do real journalism. I know, unfortunately, today there's way too many people in journalism who are simply sitting in offices or you know, sitting by computers, doing everything via Twitter, via you know, X amount of things on the internet. And that never can substitute for being out there in the field. I mean, they're not just covering drug trafficking in Mexico, but also, you know, I've covered around right across this continent from doing things like going down illegal gold mines in Colombia, you know, going into ghettos in Kingston, Jamaica, covering a coup in Honduras, covering hurricanes. It's still a great thing to do, a great thing to cover. I would, you know, really find ways to do that.
So you've been in Mexico 15 years and you've seen, I guess, the possible worst that you could see in Mexico, in its culture, and it's some of its people. Do you still have that same fondness? You said you were very fond of the people, of the culture, because of everyone you met when you were in other parts of the world. Are you still fond of Mexico and its people, regardless of all these things that you've seen and covered? What are your feelings about Mexico today, 15 years after?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mexico now has become the country where I've spent most of my adult life. I mean, now I'm 42. I arrived here when I was 27, 15 years. So I'd spent 9 years of my adult life before I came here and 15 years here. So now it's a country where I've spent most of my adult life, a country that I've grown up in, or have grown as a person, as an adult in. And it's a beautiful country, a great country with beautiful people, great people. And there's many, many great things about Mexican culture. Now, when I look at the violence in Mexico and the horrific things in Mexico, I don't look at them so much as being the products of Mexican culture or a particular thing of Mexican people. I think these are horrific things. You know, human beings all around the world do horrific, violent things in certain circumstances. You could take a nice guy out of a small town in the United States who really would have very good values and wouldn't hurt people, and put him in Vietnam or put him in Iraq, and that guy ends up committing atrocities. You know, you could look at people from England, from my country, who fought in First World War, Second World War, and committed atrocities. So once you put people in very violent situations, then they could do horrific things. You know, if you look at Mexico, and I've interviewed now many people who have been in the ranks of organized crime, who have committed many murders, in many cases more murders than they can count, who have decapitated people while they're still alive. And you trace their life stories and you find in some ways they're victimizers and victims. They get recruited when they're very young, sometimes when they're 13, 14 years old. They're in a neighborhood where the government offers nothing and where the cartel comes and starts offering them money, a cell phone, a gun, and pulls them into their ranks. Now, I don't want to be completely forgiving of these people, because if you've committed horrific crimes and really hurt people, you know, then perhaps you deserve to be judged for that. Perhaps you don't deserve redemption. Perhaps you don't deserve forgiveness. You know, it gets to a deeper question. But I don't associate that with the whole of the Mexican culture. This is a very small number of people anyway in Mexico. Mexico's a country of 120 million people. You know, you've only got, you know, maybe a couple of 100,000 might be people involved in the, you know, hardcore in the drug trade, but many, many people aren't. So there's many, many, you know, great aspects and things about Mexican culture I love, about Latin American culture that I love. Perhaps I'd love in the future to write something, be able to write, you know, a book, not just about gangsters, not just about murderers and violence, but about the positive aspects of these cultures. But yeah, it's certainly a country. I think the best of Mexico for me is in Paris. I think if you when you're there, one of the best visions I think of Mexican people is in a party. It could be a 15th birthday, it could be a wedding, but when people are enjoying a fiesta, the happiness on people's faces, that's the kind of the best often of Mexico.
Fascinating. Johan, thank you very much for giving us a glimpse into your fascinating life, into this amazing journey. And we look forward to many, many more years of you covering all this exciting stuff and things that happen in Mexico. And we thank you for your time.
Thank you. Great to be here, and all the best over there.
The title of the book, Gangsta Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. And that is available at Amazon. We will have links in the show notes to where you can buy this book. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere great books are sold. The event, January 20th at the Mid-Manhattan Library at 455 Fifth Avenue here in Manhattan. It's going to start at 6:30 p.m., I will be there, and I'd love it if you join us. Come by, say hello. Now, if you want to get in touch with me, you can shoot me an email at robaguilarshow@gmail.com. That's A-G-U-I-L-A-R, robaguilarshow@gmail.com. If you have comments, suggestions, if there's a topic you'd like for us to cover, if there's something you want to talk about, shoot me an email, and we'll get you on the show. I'm going to leave you with some narco corridos, and that is the music that sings about these drug lords, especially now with the capture of El Chapo. I always compare it to, like, for example, the hip-hop of that culture, where they sing about these guys, what they do, what they live through. And in some instances, some people view it as glorifying it. Corridos in the Mexican culture have existed for many, many years, way before there was even a narco culture. They were basically songs about history, about things that people lived through. And now they so happen that they sing about this narco culture. So up next, Trippin' Beats. Stick around. Thank you very much for hanging out. I'll see you all in the promised land.
A mí me gustan los corridos porque son los hechos reales de nuestro pueblo.
Sí, a mí también me gustan porque en ellos se canta la pura verdad.
Pues ponlos pues, órale, ahí va.
Soy el jefe de jefes, señores. Me respetan a todos niveles. A mí el periodista me quiere, y si no mi amistad se la pierde. Muchos pollos que apenas nacieron ya se quieren pelear con el gallo. Si pudieran estar a mi altura, pues tendrían que pasar muchos años. Y no pienso dejarles el puesto donde yo me la paso ordenando. Mi trabajo y valor me ha costado manejar los contactos que tengo. Muchos quieren escalar mi altura, no más miro que se van cayendo. Han querido arañar mi corona, los que intentan se han ido muriendo. Yo navego debajo del agua y también sé volar a la altura. Muchos creen que me gobierno, otros dicen que es pura mentira. Desde arriba no más me divierto, pues me gusta que así se confundan. las cuentas se lleva una regla. Desde el uno llegar hasta el cien. El que quiera ser hombre derecho, que se enseñe a mirar su nivel. Sin talento no busques grandeza, porque nunca la vas a tener. Soy el jefe de jefes, señores, y decirlo no es por presunción. Muchos grandes me piden favores, porque saben que soy el mejor. Han buscado la sombra del árbol para que no les dé duro el sol.
Sirves para que te mate. Yo cristianos. Único para mi gente, pues he sabido tratarlo. Apoyado por el virus, ese que anda remangando. No respeta diferencias, es empeño en mi trabajo. En preparación me encuentro para integrarme al equipo. Charola de maldito, por eso soy efectivo en la mafia conocido. Número uno pa' mi gente, colaborador activo.
Con cuerno de chivo y bazooka en la nuca, volando cabezas al que se atraviesa. Somos sanguinarios, locos, bien ondeados, nos gusta matar.
Para dar levantones somos los mejores, siempre en caravana, toda mi plebada. Vienen pecherados, blindados y listos para ejecutar. Con una llamada privada se activan los altos niveles de los aceleres. Torturaciones, balas y explosiones para controlar.
La gente se asusta y nunca se pregunta si ven los comandos cuando van pasando. Todos enfierrados, bien encapuchados y bien camuflados.
Agencia, balazos, ráfagas continuas que no se terminan. Cuchillo afilado, cuerno atravesado para degollar.
Traen mente de varios revolucionarios como Pancho Villa, peleando en guerrilla, limpiando el terreno con bazooka y cuerno que hacen retumbar.
El macho adelante con el comandante para acabar con lacras, todo el virus antrax, equipo violento. Trabajo sangriento pa' traumatizar.
Soy el número uno, declámeme uno, respaldado por el mayor y por el Chapo. La JT siempre presente y pendiente a su apoyo dar.
Seguiré creciendo y más gente cayendo por algo. Soy el ondeador respetado, Manuel Torres Félix, mi nombre y saludos para Culiacán.
Como hueso con el movimiento alterado. Puro tuyo.
Me gusta andar por la sierra.
¡Gana! hicieron viaje redondo, aceptaron la propuesta. Son muchachas aventadas que el miedo no les afecta. Ganaban dinero y se divertían, viajaban seguido de lujo bestial. Y así comienza la historia de estas lindas muchachitas. Pamela, la más bonita, la Lupes atrabancada, Laurita Pan, ese Barbie de Sinaloa, la muchacha. También hay enfermas que admiran la mafia, hijas de pesados de gran importancia. Ahora son pieza importante, por algo son empresarias. Son los viajes Panamá, por algo tan conocidos, material sofisticado y jefes del mecanismo. Unos de Colombia, otros jamaicanos, Sinaloa y La Perla tienen sus macizos. Es un proceso importante que tiene mucho peligro. Grandes mafias, puntos exclusivos y las grandes oficinas respetan sus atractivos. Visitan fincas famosas de narcos ya retirados. Disfrutan de los placeres, para eso andan trabajando. Aviones privados, los carros blindados, hoteles de lujo, dinero sobra. De muy buen respaldo, de Mazatlán a La Perla, en puro carro blindado.
100 balazos al blindaje de mi carro disparaban, creían que iban a matarme, jamás se lo imaginaban, que la ráfaga de cuerno en mi vidrio calles de Culiacán, donde a gusto me paseaba, parecían el mismo infierno al venirse la emboscada. La humadera de los rifles a la gente amedrentaba. Ya estoy curado de espantos, no es la primera vez que lo hacen. Cuando escogí este negocio, sabía que podrían matarme. El problema es que estoy vivo y ahora van a lamentarse. Tengo un escuadrón de muerte, pistoleros que no fallan. Soy un hombre sanguinario, sin temor a las batallas. Tengo un historial de guerra que mi carrera respalda. No hay manera de ocultarse, voy a remangar parejo. Tengo el apoyo del viejo, de voltear todo el terreno. Voy a dar con los culpables y eso ténganlo por hecho. Van a con hoy sabrán quién es su padre. Traicionaron mi confianza y ahora tendrán que atorarle. Y ese llanto de mi madre van a pagarlo con sangre.